Case number 19-2054, United States of America versus Denver Lee. Arguments not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Brandt, you may proceed for the appellant.
Thank you. Good afternoon. May it please the court. Mr. Meissner. Jeff Brandt on behalf of defendant appellant, Denver Lee. Our position is the district court abused its discretion, clearly erred and constitutionally erred by permitting the government to cross-examine Mr. Lee based upon a prior conviction for possession as a felon. Our position is that not only was that harmful, not harmless, but extremely prejudicial. He had not opened the door to that evidence because he had not testified in conflict with that prior conviction.
Can I ask you what is your view under which this evidence was introduced? Was it, I saw three options: Rule 608, Rule 609, or the case law seems to call the impeachment by contradiction rule, which I take to mean if you assert a fact. On cross-examination, you're allowed to explain why that fact is not true. Do you have an instinct or a position on what rule of law or rule of evidence this evidence came in?
I wasn't the counsel in the district court, but from the record, it seems to me that it changed. That before Mr. Lee testified, it was going to come in under Rule 609, and then with the balance of 403, the district court judge finding that the probative value was very little, but the prejudice with the prior drug convictions was also not much, but the prior drug conviction was prejudicial because it was the exact same offense. I think that changed once Mr. Lee testified, because the government then, I think, invoked that impeachment rule in the case law to say Mr. Lee has now testified in conflict with his prior conviction. Therefore, now we can. And I think in conjunction also argued that changed the probative value of the prior conviction.
Do you concede that the meaning of your client's testimony? So the district court found that your client essentially testified that he was never around guns. It was a longstanding practice. And that's why the district court thought that this impeachment would have value, because it would suggest that maybe it wasn't so much of a longstanding practice. Do you concede that that finding is a factual finding that we review for clear error?
I know that the district court didn't really make that holding. The government proposed that, and then the district court said, on that theory, we'll allow the government to cross-examine. But when I look at that part of the record, and I'll have a cite for the court in a moment, I think it's 570, page ID 575. I don't think the district court judge is making that holding, but assuming that the court is making that holding in support, I think I have to concede that that part is a clear error review, that the court has to review and see whether that's unsupported by what Mr. Lee actually stated.
And do you think, my instinct was just the nevers, maybe the few nevers or whatnot may have been, if I'm reading the cold transcript, you might have something there. But then I saw that he testified about another incident in the winter where he said that he was in a car with somebody who had a gun, and he immediately got out of the car, which obviously didn't happen on this occasion. And it could provide support for a factual finding that he was talking not just specifically about this occasion, but was talking more generally about a longstanding practice.
I think the two portions of the record that the government cite in support of a finding that Mr. Lee is saying forever, both context show the opposite, that he's talking every time he's using never or ever, he's talking about this specific gun or being in Ms. Safadi's car. And the time he seems to be speaking generally speaks in present tense. And, you know, conceitedly, colloquially, that's not grammatically correct to say, I don't be around guns. But it's also in his community and how he's grown up, his way of saying, I, at that time, in the context of when I'm being asked a question, I didn't possess weapons. I don't think that even with, if I get Your Honor's point that another time he's talking, and that might provide context, but there's another time that he said, and I'll give a cite in a moment for the court. There's another time he says, I always run. Does that mean he's been running since forever? He uses the word always to mean now. And I think the overall context.
It does. It's definitely, even under his view, I have to think, because he gave another example, it at least means more than just this one incident. It means that there's some type of pre-existing practice. I guess what I'm getting at, if it's a deferential standard of review, and then we have evidence suggesting that it's more than this, just this one occasion, doesn't that make it difficult for us to overturn the judge who was watched him and saw his credibility and could see his body language and more closely kind of get the feel for what he was implying to the jury?
If it were a credibility issue, I think that's stronger. But I think when we're talking about what it was the government's burden to show that what Mr. Lee said was, quote, in conflict with his prior conviction. And I don't think there's a single line in the transcript, or even in the context that he's being asked the question, that it shows that it's in conflict. He uses the present tense, and I think that if we look greater than just what he's asked, I actually think that supports our view that he uses the words, he uses the present tense to talk about those instances, February 2018. And I think the government's cross-examination actually helped show this. When the government cross-examines Mr. Lee and says, hey, look, you just testified that you're never around guns, he immediately, no hesitation, says, yeah, in 2018. And the government tries to pin him down harder to try to get him to say what it would like this court to interpret it, him as saying now, but tries to get him to say it. And he goes, no, that's not what happened. I'm saying back then I didn't do it. And here's why, because in 2005, I got in trouble. And from then on, I didn't like to be around guns. And I think that helps.
Is the standard here, counselor, what we used to call, he opened the door. So that what that would do is we are looking at the record itself as to how he responds, because now we're outside the rules of evidence, right? We are in the general rule, which historically I understood to be, I'm not going to let you put this into the record. Now you're testifying. Well, you have opened the door. You have opened the door. And so you will be cross-examined on it. So that limits our review of whether that language opened the door that had been closed because of potential prejudicial nature of that evidence is now open because the testifying individual opened it. So your argument is that he never opened the door. I understand there's some pretty generic language in there about I never, I always, and I'll ask your opposing counsel the same question. Where is it in particular in this transcript that you would say this testifying witness opened the door? Is there one?
There's no point. And I think I go through the brief and say, here's the first time he talks about the gun and he uses the word never, but look how he's talking about that day. He's asked specifically, what were you wearing? And in that context is the first time he says never. And the next time it comes up, it's about the car. Were you in the car? Yeah, briefly. Did you see a gun in there? No, never at no time. And then the next time they're talking, it's about, again, about the day and when the police officers approach him. And the closest he ever comes is by saying, But did you possess that weapon? Never, never. Y'all look at the tape. And that's page ID 571. The government's response brief seems to point more to page ID 575 when Mr. Lee says, she, meaning Lena Zapata, no, I don't have guns around me. And I guess the extrapolation is I don't have guns around me means forever. But in the context, he's talking about his assistant on that day and why no gun should be around him. I think again,
well, then doesn't the question become whether if this was in fact error, it was harmless error?
Yes, Your Honor. And again, we submitted.
Why was it not harmless error in light of the of all the evidence in the case?
Well, the evidence is the Detective Brent's claims he pulled the gun off of Mr. Lee. One other officer says he saw that happen. Mr. Lee testifies that he didn't have a gun. The gun's registered to someone else who's at the scene. This creates a genuine issue for the jury on who's telling the truth. But the jury, instead of just having that question open for let's decide who's credible, is told, and I see the red card's up, but if I could finish this sentence,
go ahead, yeah.
Is told that this defendant has this exact same prior conviction. And that is so prejudicial. There's no jury instruction in the world that could unring that bell.
Thank you. And do you, in your estimation, does the video answer the question?
I don't think it does. The video doesn't show the gun come out of the pocket. The video only in conjunction with the officer testifying shows that that gun was taken from Mr. Lee.
And if the video showed, we do not yet possess the video. If the video showed that there was bulk in the hoodie pocket that suggests a weapon, wouldn't that undercut your case?
It would, but I don't think that's what the video shows. And the testimony also was he had other things in his pockets like keys and cash. But I think the government's strongest video is 7A, but it still does not show that gun coming from Mr. Lee.
Other questions?
If you don't mind, I might switch briefly one question about the Rahaf issue. What's your best argument for distinguishing the Cotton case, the Supreme Court case involving a drug quantity not alleged in the indictment? It seems to me that that's on all fours with this case because it wasn't alleged in the indictment and the court, but it wasn't argued. So clear error applied or plain error applied. And then they found that they reserved the question whether that type of error is structural, but then they found under prong four that that type of error was not problematic because it was harmless.
Yes, James Murphy. I think our best argument is that Cotton had to do with 841, where drug quantity isn't an element of defense until you talk about sentencing. The same is not true here. We can have a drug conspiracy conviction if we don't have an exact drug amount proved, but that's not true when it comes to 922G now. You can't have a conviction without one of those elements proved and then just move on to sentencing to decide the level of punishment.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Any further questions? All right, opposing counsel.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the court, John Mike, on behalf of the United States. A criminal defendant has a right to testify in his defense, but not a right to mislead the jury without. The district judge in this case was very careful with Mr. Lee's prior firearm conviction. When the government initially sought to introduce it under Federal Rule of Evidence 609, the court did a careful analysis and decided to initially keep the conviction out because it was worried about any possible prejudice. But then Mr. Lee's testimony forced the judge's hand and changed his mind. Mr. Lee got up on the stand and on a direct examination of his own doing, he made broad statements indicating that he was not the kind of person who would have a gun.
Please go ahead.
I was just going to ask the same question that I asked before, which is what's your view on what rule of evidence this was entered under, 608, 609? Or what is known as the rule against a rule of contradiction.
Your Honor, I believe the government's purpose was introducing it as impeachment by contradiction. I think there is some support in the record that the court also thought that Mr. Lee's testimony changed the probative value of the conviction under Rule 609. If you look at the portion of the transcript, I think it's page ID 578, where the court is making this ruling at the sidebar. The court says, I find it's within the 10-year period. The court also mentions Rule 608 at that point. So I think it is a little bit of a blurry line question, but it's clear the court thought there was some probative value both in the conviction for its inherent impeaching nature under Rule 609, but also its nature in contradicting the testimony that Lee had given on the stand.
And is it your view that Rule 403 balancing is a gloss? So even if it's the rule of impeachment by contradiction, Rule 403 would still apply to that, wouldn't it?
That's correct, Your Honor. It would. The standard is a little bit different from the standard in Rule 609. In Rule 609, it's only if the evidence is more probative than its prejudicial effects. Under Rule 403, evidence is only excluded if it's substantially more prejudicial than probative. But, Your Honor, the prejudicial effect here was actually quite minimal. And this is something I think maybe didn't get emphasized quite enough in the briefs, but this is a very small portion of the trial. There was about one page of cross-exam testimony where this is discussed. The government never raised this conviction once during its closing argument. The defense never raised the conviction once during its closing argument. And the cross-examination focused exclusively on the question of whether this conviction contradicted the testimony that Mr. Lee had given. And I'd like to be very clear for the court, the broad language that Mr. Lee talked about as far as his policy of not keeping guns around him. He talks generally about his police interaction. And this is on page ID 574 and 575 is what I think is the best example of it. He's talking about the police and says, if they pull up on a crowd, I always go to jail. Anytime anything ever shaking, if I'm in a crowd, that's why I tell people around me, don't bring nothing around me. So he's not talking about this one incident. And I think even the defense in its brief concedes, he's not talking about just that night. He's talking about a policy that he has not to keep guns around him. He then went on to say right after
the policy, the real question of that policy is not whether he's had it his whole life, but whether it comes as a result of prior convictions, which makes the possession a crime for him. So help me understand. It seems to me that either he's saying, I just never do that. All my life, I have not had guns around me. That's one thing. But to say, I don't have guns around me since I was convicted before because it creates problems for me. Why would that open the door to the admission of a comparable prior conviction?
Well, Judge, a couple of responses. First, I think the case would be a little bit different if Mr. Lee had said, I don't keep guns around me since I became a felon because I'm not allowed to have them.
Did he not, in fact, say that in response to the government's questions? When they were trying to tie him down about what he meant, he said, not anymore, not since, 2005 or whatever the date was.
He did say that after ruling occurred, Your Honor. In part, I think that actually takes away a little bit of the prejudice because Mr. Lee was able to take that prior conviction and use it to further what his defense was, which was he didn't keep any guns around him after 2005. That theory also doesn't really make any sense because Mr. Lee had been a felon well before that 2005 drug conviction. He actually had four prior convictions before that, including another firearm conviction. So first of all, it wouldn't make any sense for his policy not to keep guns around him to have begun in 2005 because he's already a prohibited person.
I was going to say, if his implication was because I was a felon, that would still be impeachment by contradiction because that shows that his felon status did not disqualify his gun or his instinct to carry guns, at least in 2005. But the fact of the matter is, I just find it the transcript ambiguous on how far back he was referring to. And so what's your position on how we're supposed to resolve this issue when there's this inherent ambiguity about kind of what he was referring to, how far back? I know that there is one example where he gives not just this incident, but another incident where he says he jumped out of the car because there was a gun in it. But what should we do in response to this ambiguity?
Well, Judge, I think, as you mentioned, this case is a good one to show why there is a deferential standard of review in this sort of circumstance. So this court reviews for clear error the district court's factual findings. And I think one important thing to note is this: the testimony here actually changed the judge's mind. So it might be one thing if this were a case where the judge was being very cavalier about Mr. Lee's prior convictions. But the court here was intended to keep this conviction out from the beginning, and the testimony was significant enough to make the judge think that Mr. Lee had opened the door. And I think when you read the entire transcript, it is a little bit difficult when you're looking at a cold record and the district court has a better sense of what all of Mr. Lee's testimony means. So I think that standard comes into play when you have a somewhat ambiguous transcript like you mentioned here, Judge.
What do you make of the notion that there wasn't actually a factual finding? Opposing counsel suggested, I know what paragraph he was referring to when the judge issued the order. The judge just said, I agree, he's opened the door and there's a rebalancing. Do you think that paragraph should get clear error review?
I think it should, Judge. There's also a more clear factual finding later on when the court denied Mr. Lee's motion for a new trial. It's at page ID 798. And the court put this in detail there. There, the court actually expressly relies on impeachment by contract as the basis for admitting the evidence. And it also makes a factual finding saying that Mr. Lee essentially testified that he shunned guns. And it quotes the portion of the record that I just mentioned where Mr. Lee said, I don't want no guns. Ms. Safadi knows not to bring no guns around me. I don't have nothing around me because I'm always the hit. So I think that testimony that the court was most relying on, I think it is a factual finding that the court finds that testimony was contradictory with Mr. Lee's prior conviction, and so it should get a significant amount of deference here. Again, the defense focuses a lot on the prejudicial effect, but this is a very minor amount of testimony that came in. Again, about one page of transcript testimony, never once mentioned during the closing argument from either side.
But wouldn't we have to say, counsel, that having proof in the record that you've committed this exact crime before would tend to impact the jury's thinking? How could it not?
I certainly think there's some risk of prejudice there, and that's what the district court was thinking when it initially the evidence under Rule 609. I think given that, I agree, when you have the same conviction, there's some risk of prejudice there. But given that circumstance, this is the kind of situation where there's the least prejudice possible because the government didn't get up at closing argument and start hammering away at that conviction. It never once mentioned it again. It didn't use that conviction as a sword during the cross-exam. It only asked Mr. Lee questions about that conviction in context with what his direct exam testimony was. And Mr. Lee explained away what he said as far as why he had that change in policy. So while there is some risk of prejudice, Your Honor, it's relatively minimal given the way it all played out at trial.
Let me finish up and then you take over if we trade. Thank you. Would you address the harmless error? This is a pretty in-depth record. Let's just assume that it was improper to let it in. Why would that be harmless error in your estimation?
It would be harmless primarily for two reasons. One, because the prejudicial effect was minimal, as I just described. But second, because the evidence in this case was overwhelming. There was testimony from three separate DPD officers who all testified. They saw Officer Brents as he was retrieving the gun from Mr. Lee's pocket. There was also body camera footage. Now, I know the court hasn't reviewed it yet. I hope it made it over to you. I want to be clear, Your Honor, the body camera footage begins right as that gun is being retrieved. And so it doesn't have a clear picture of Officer Brents as he's reaching into Mr. Lee's pocket. What it does show.
The question, why was the camera not on when the police officer approached?
There was some testimony about this at trial, Your Honor. The officers had a policy of trying to turn on their body cameras. You have to activate it by pressing a button as soon as the citizen interaction occurred. This was a very fast developing situation where the officers came up, saw the bulge in Mr. Lee's pocket, and were trying to respond to that very quickly. So what actually happens, and there's testimony about this in the record as well, is once the officers activate those body cameras, they capture the 30 seconds prior to when that button was pushed. Yes. So when you watch the body cameras, you can see right as Officer Brents is recovering the gun, you see it in Officer Brents' hand as he's coming out of the pocket. You see him making the gun safe. And this was all played sort of frame by frame for the jury. And then after that, you hear the officers make a signal saying Eagles, which is, hey, everyone activate your body camera. We're in a citizen interaction here. So the officers did activate it. I think they were acting in good faith, trying to activate it as quickly as possible. But I do want to be clear, when you do watch the footage, you won't see the portions before right as the gun was retrieved. There are, however, two different angles, one from Officer Brents, which shows the gun in his hand as he's pulling it out of Mr. Lee's pocket, and a separate angle where you can see Officer Brents reaching around as he's reaching into that pocket. So there was body camera footage. There was also—
Thank you for answering my question. I believe I interrupted Judge Murphy.
So I was just gonna switch briefly to the Rahaf issue, and I just did a general canvas of the circuit cases and saw that the Fourth Circuit has suggested that, at least in the guilty plea context, the Rahaf issue is structural error in a case called Geary. I'm not certain whether you're familiar with the case or not, but I was curious whether you could opine on whether a missing element from an indictment should be deemed structural error and what we should do about that. I know the Supreme Court reserved it in Cotton and it reserved it in a later case. And so I was just curious to get the government's position on it.
Your Honor, we don't believe it's structural error. I'm not familiar with that case, I have to confess. But I think the same issue here, at least the question about the court's jurisdiction, was squarely dealt with in the Hobbs case, which had essentially this exact same question. I believe Judge Strange was on panel for that case. It was a case involving, just like this one, a felon in possession conviction. Just like this one, it came before Rahaf, and so that element was not alleged in the indictment. There was no, you know, consideration about structural error there, and that court relied on Cotton in saying the court's not deprived of jurisdiction when the indictment fails to allege an element. Again, I'm not familiar with that Fourth Circuit decision, so I can't, I guess, speak as to that. But
there's a certain query, though. This case requires us to go a little bit further, though, doesn't it? Because there's an argument not just that it's not jurisdictional, but also that it was just error to fail to include an element in the indictment. And I believe at the end of that case, there's a footnote that suggested that there was no other argument other than the pure jurisdictional argument.
That's correct, Your Honor. I guess what I'll note is I don't think any Sixth Circuit case has squarely dealt with that issue, and I don't think the defense really raised structural error in their brief, but virtually the same issue as this case came up in the Ward decision. We submitted a Rule 28J letter on that. It came out after the party's briefing, and also in the Conley decision, which is unpublished. Those cases all dealt with circumstances very similar to these. Actually, this case was a more clear one because Mr. Lee's stipulation was not just that he was a felon. It was also a stipulation that he knew he was convicted of a felony on the day of the offense in question. So there's really no question here that the government could have demonstrated that had it been alleged in the indictment. In fact, it did demonstrate it through that stipulation. And there's really no indication that any of Mr. Lee's substantial rights were affected. He also kind of argues in a contradictory nature between his first issue and the second one, because if Mr. Lee didn't stipulate that he was aware of the felony conviction, certainly the length of sentence he served on that firearm conviction, which was 7 years, would come into evidence in order to demonstrate that he actually knew he was a felon on the date in question. And I see my time is up, Your Honor. Unless there are any further questions, we ask that the district court be affirmed.
Thank you. Rebuttal. I think your mute button may be on.
It was.
Brooks. Thank you.
Okay, I'll get the hang of this by the time we do this 20 times.
That's right.
I won't take all 4 minutes. I think I'll say it sounds like, at least for the first issue, it comes down to prejudice and harmlessness. And I feel that the strongest part about that is really, it doesn't matter if it's only one page or four pages. And whether it doesn't come down to whether the defense brings up a prior conviction. The reality is here, and we've got case law in the brief, not just from this circuit, but other circuits and even district court cases, to the degree that it's not binding, obviously, but that when a jury hears that the defendant has this exact same conviction, it's extremely prejudicial. And with great respect for the government, it sounds like the defense to that is, well, we didn't really hammer it. We just brought it up once. And I think bringing it up once is extremely prejudicial. The fact that the government didn't hammer on it instead of being a feather in their cap is their good faith ability to stick to the limiting instruction. If they would have brought it up a few more times, the argument would be stronger that there would be a different argument that the government engaged in misconduct and violated the limiting instruction. So although I appreciate the government not bringing it up time and time again, I think that's more the absence of additional error, not the lack of prejudice to my client.
Would you respond to your opposing counsel's argument regarding harmless error?
I think I just made my best case that
harmless error, really what I want you to address is the overwhelming nature of the evidence. And that's the standard there, not just was it prejudicial. Let's assume it was. Why was it harmful error?
Because the video does not show the gun coming from Mr. Lee's pocket, because it's the officer's testimony that creates the evidence against Mr. Lee. Mr. Lee takes the stand, creating an issue of credibility for the jury, not the judge, not us, for the jury. So the jury has to make a decision. Is this weapon that's not registered to Mr. Lee, but it's registered to someone else who's actually on the scene, did that come from Mr. Lee, or is Mr. Lee telling the truth that he did not possess it? So once that goes to the jury, I think it's a toss-up. It's a 50-50. The problem is the jury's told he's done this before, and I think that wins the government's case for it. I think the jury turns off its decision-making, its balancing on credibility, and puts it all in what is an unfortunate an inference that he must be guilty because he's done this before, instead of letting the jury decide who was telling the truth. Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate both your arguments. The case will be taken under advisement and an opinion rendered in due course.